The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look back at Gilbert de Motier, better known as the Marquis de Lafayette. At the Gilcrease Museum, you can see a bust of Lafayette by the sculptor Houdin, a sculpture commissioned, ironically, not for his actions during the American Revolution, but for his role at the beginning of the French Revolution. But just a few years later, during the Reign of Terror, Robespierre's Jacobins would be calling for Lafayette's head as well. In fact, Lafayette was a hero in America, not France. My guest today was intrigued by that fact, that Lafayette, who cherished American ideals of liberty and freedom, would be considered too American for the French and too French to be American. Laura Arricchio, a specialist in 18th century French history and art and the Dean of Undergraduate Studies at the New School in New York City, has written an intriguing biography titled The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. It's published by Knopf, which gives us new insight on how and why a rich 19-year-old French aristocrat, out of favor and out of step in Louis XVI's court, would come to America to fight for American independence. 7 years of research gives us a more complete view of Lafayette's motivations, his love of America and Americans, and his role in three revolutions, one in America plus two in France, and why when he died, America went into mourning, yet to the French, he was virtually forgotten. The name of the book is The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. Laura Arricchio, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
You know, there have been all sorts of books on the leaders of the American Revolution over about the last decade. It seems like we're in this period where historians are reexamining their stories, but I can't think I've seen anything about the Marquis de Lafayette. What led to your interest in Lafayette?
Well, you know, I actually came to the subject from the French side of things. My first few books have been all about France in this period of time. And one thing that I came to realize was that although Lafayette is a hero here, and we have, you know, hundreds of places and towns named after him, in France he really was not a hero. And I became intrigued by this and wanted to sort of figure out how that happened.
In fact, there was a small amount of time when he was considered idyllic and sort of heroic for his championing of the American Revolution at a time when the revolution was sort of in fashion.
Yes,
in France.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He was, the revolution was very much, the American Revolution was very much in fashion in France in 1776, 77, and Lafayette was probably one of the most enthusiastic Frenchmen about the American Revolution. But during the French Revolution, he stumbled into some real difficulties. I think that the circumstances of the French Revolution were just so very different, so much violent change, it was very hard, I think, for him to maintain that the same kind of prestige that he had before.
I think he's sympathetic because he's basically choosing a middle, pragmatic course
exactly.
In a time of madness.
No, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, he was a moderate during the French Revolution, and he stuck to those principles of moderation. He wanted reform, but not revolution in France. And I think that this was a time when there were very, very few people who were willing to stand firmly with moderate principles. And I think that ended up costing him the respect of both sides. Both the royalists disliked him. They thought that he was a traitor to their class. And on the left, the radicals disliked him as well. It was a very difficult moment for him.
It was really interesting reading about his early life because first of all, when you see paintings of Lafayette, especially sort of the romanticized views of the Revolution, one, you do see an accurate depiction of him as this boy-like figure.
Yeah.
But he was a boy-like figure when he was here. He was like 19, 20 years old, which is, my mind has been difficult getting around the idea that the leaders of the Revolution, you know, I guess in America, money talks. He was rich.
Yeah.
But this 20-year-old kid coming over from France, and then all of a sudden it's like, I want to be a general.
It's true. Yeah, it's sort of a fascinating story. When he came over, he was raised in a noble family that believed in glory, and in particular military glory, as the ideal that he should really try to achieve. Unfortunately, at the time in France, there were a lot of reforms going on in the army, so that he really couldn't find that kind of glory there in the 1770s. So America became the place where he was able to pursue this dream he had of military valor. But he had never seen a day of battlefield action when he arrived here. So he was 19 years old. He had never seen battle. And he shows up and wants to be put in charge of a regiment. And initially, George Washington's not entirely sure what to do about it, actually. And what he eventually does is take him under his wing, and Washington really mentors him, teaches him, is very patient with him, instructs him, reassures him when things go wrong, and really helps him grow into the tremendous general that he became.
That was one of the most interesting things of all the foreign-born men who helped the Continental Army during the Revolution. I was intrigued by why Americans venerated Lafayette over the others.
It's a really interesting point because everybody at the time also talked about it. Even Washington talked about it. They were not necessarily all that fond of some of the Frenchmen who came over. A lot of them were mercenaries in the early days. And Washington had fought against the French, in fact, in the French and Indian War. So there was no necessarily love lost between these groups. But I think that Lafayette just seemed more American than the average Frenchman. He had been born in a rural area in France. And although he was a Marquis, he came from a sort of rustic environment, and he had very sort of straightforward, plain-spoken, direct manners of the kind that were not very fashionable in France, but that were the way that Americans liked to deal with each other and with other people. And I think that that sort of earnest directness, forthrightness, really charmed Americans who were sort of surprised to find these characteristics in a French nobleman.
And in fact, as you write in his early life, that put him on the wrong foot in Versailles. He was fairly provincial. The Marquis is, you know, that's a mid-level aristocrat. But the thing was he was born in a family where all of his older relatives died and left him a lot of money.
It's exactly right. That's exactly right. So what happened was, his family had a habit of marrying well and dying young. So that he ended up as a teenager with an extraordinary amount of money. Now, this is a time when marriages were not love matches among the aristocracy. And so a boy like him, who had no connections but a lot of money, was married into a family that had a great deal of connections, but maybe not so much money. So he married into a family that was very influential at the court at Versailles. And this, unfortunately, though, didn't work out so well for him at first because he, as he described it himself, he was, quote-unquote, gauche. There's a story that circulated, which might or might not be true, but that said that he danced so badly that Marie Antoinette actually laughed at him. He sat badly on his horse. You know, he didn't have the proper gait. He didn't have the proper stance. And so he was a bit of an outsider at the court of Versailles.
And even though he married into that family, the family was doing their best. So how did he become fixated on America and the Revolution? Was it given to his classical education? He kind of saw the Revolution as in this classical idea of democracy and republicanism?
Absolutely. I think that there were a few different elements that went into his fascination with the American Revolution. One is exactly as you say. You know, at that time, all of the young men in France who were educated at all were educated in the Latin classics. And they told tales of the great republics of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. And I think that Lafayette was really captivated by these ideals, as were many of his classmates. But he truly excelled at Latin. And this provided him with a real sort of vision of what a virtuous government, a virtuous republic could look like. At the same time, also, he hated the English, like any good Frenchman of his class at the time. His father had been killed, actually, fighting the English. And France had recently lost a great deal of territory to England in the French and Indian Wars. So there was a real desire to get back at England. Lafayette also, I think, was someone who was really looking for a cause. He was really casting about aimlessly in France. He was not comfortable at court. He was not succeeding. He had actually, his in-laws attempted to get him a place in the retinue of one of the king's brothers, and he actually insulted the king's brother presumably intentionally, actually, because he said he wanted to spare himself the, quote, inglorious life of a courtier. He didn't think it was a worthy life, and he wanted to get himself out of that. And the American cause struck him as, I think, just the perfect opportunity to realize some of his ideals and really do good for mankind.
He bought a ship to come over to the United States, and he was actually forbade from doing that by King Louis, but sort of through intrigue managed to leave and come across. And I suppose that also sort of affected Americans' attitudes toward him, the fact that the King of France had basically forbidden this royal person, this aristocrat, to come over, and yet he did anyway, and he served without pay. He was not a mercenary.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, that some of the other men who crossed, in fact, those who crossed with him, were here strictly for the money. That's all they're in it for. And he absolutely wasn't. He had more money than he needed. He, because of this habit of his family of dying young and marrying well, he had a great deal of spare cash at his disposal. Also, he was an orphan, which was also meant that he had more control over his own funds than other young men of his age. So he was able to purchase his own ship and to come over here of his own accord. It's kind of interesting, though. The French were supporting the United States, the American cause, but only clandestinely up until then. They were sending shipments of arms. They were sending occasional experts, engineers, and so forth. But France wanted to maintain the appearance of neutrality in the war. And the last thing in the world that they wanted was a well-connected member of their high society to make a big splash by openly siding with the Americans. And that, of course, is precisely what Lafayette did, and he really created quite a stir on both sides of the Atlantic.
Well, he was attached to George Washington's staff. He distinguished himself pretty early in the Battle of Brandywine, which was one of the battles leading to the loss of Philadelphia.
Exactly.
He recovered at a Moravian fellowship, and that was sort of an influence. You found, as you through your research, that was sort of, he really ingratiated himself to that community.
He really did. I think that Lafayette was enamored of America. You know, I was thinking about this the other day. I think that when he landed on American shores, it was love at first sight. He found everything that he had always wanted here. He found what he thought was a land of brotherhood, of simplicity, of honest virtue, and all of these things he found among the Moravian Brotherhood in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And he continued to be really fascinated by American groups like the Shakers. He really was very interested in religious groups that were not Catholic like he was from France, but groups that were founded on Christian ideals of brotherhood and fellowship.
And of course, that fascination with America went far beyond his time here during the Revolution when he went back to Europe and his own home. He was regularly sending hounds to George Washington, Great Pyrenees dogs to another Maryland farmer. He was importing American species and planting them on his estate at LaGrange. In fact, he referred to it as American ground.
He did. He did. It was... You know, I think that whereas a lot of the other Frenchmen who served in the Revolution, and there were thousands of them, and many lost their lives. I mean, we really owe a debt to France. But for the most of the other Frenchmen who came over, they returned to their lives, whatever lives they had been living before, and this was just sort of an episode. For Lafayette, it was different. For Lafayette, his time in America really became, I think, the defining moment of his life, even though he was only 19 when he got here. And so his American character, his American identity, his American reputation was something that he really cultivated throughout his entire life. In Paris, in his townhouse, he kept a gold engraved copy of the Declaration of Independence on his wall. He said he always wanted to be able to look at it for inspiration. He kept busts of great Americans. He kept portraits of George Washington. He had Adams and Jefferson and Franklin over for dinner every Monday. It was really very much a part of who he was.
Yeah, that household was sort of an American salon in the early days after the Revolution, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And he named his son George Washington Lafayette, and he named a daughter Virginia, Virginie. It was actually a funny little story. He and Ben Franklin had a sort of joking relationship. I guess Ben Franklin had joking relationships with a lot of folks. But Franklin wrote to Lafayette when Lafayette named his daughter Virginia. Franklin wrote to him and said that he hoped that he would have 13 children so that he can name one after each state of the Union.
Although he did say, I feel sorry for the boy named Massachusetts.
Yes, exactly. Or the girl named Miss Connecticut.
Well, my guest today is Laura Auricchio, the Dean of the School of Undergraduate Studies at the New School in New York City. She's a specialist on 18th century French culture, and her new book is a really fascinating history of the Marquis de Lafayette, The Marquis Lafayette Reconsidered. It's published by Knopf. Let's talk a little bit about the relationship between Lafayette and George Washington. It really was. We think of a couple of really close relationships that Washington had in the war. One was with Alexander Hamilton.
Absolutely.
And with Lafayette. And I'm not sure which was closer, but both of them, he was a great mentor too. And it seems like it was, for Lafayette, it was almost like a surrogate father.
He was, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Both Hamilton and Lafayette were orphans, I think, when they met Washington. And I know that for Lafayette, at least, he was immediately taken with Washington the very moment that he saw him. Lafayette's father had been killed when Lafayette, was only 2 years old, or not yet 2 years old. So he had grown up without a father. And in 18th century France, he was kind of tall. He was kind of tended to be stout. He was kind of ungainly. He was kind of bulky. And his height, Lafayette's height, was something that had sort of counted against him. When he comes to America and he first sees George Washington, he's at the City Tavern in Philadelphia, and he sees Washington across the room, across the crowd, and what strikes him immediately is how regally and nobly Washington carries his great height, because, of course, Washington towered over almost everybody. And from that moment, Lafayette, well, no pun intended, but he literally looked up to him. He really thought that Washington represented the ideal of virtuous manhood.
Throughout Lafayette's life, at least in the early part of his life, he was so impetuous. You know, and I suppose that's a sign of youth, but he upset Admiral D'Estaing, who came over with a French fleet, for basically giving him marching orders.
Yes, exactly.
And he was absolutely, you know, just to me, it's really interesting that, you know, okay, this 20-year-old guy comes over here and he's able to get away with it. And also, you know, he does distinguish himself on the battlefield. He, in the final parts of the war, he holds up the British force in Virginia so they can basically come into a pincher, and creates the reason for Yorktown, and actually led one of the first assaults at Yorktown.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, his impetuousness is one of his oddly most endearing traits, I think. He was an enthusiastic young man. I mean, I don't know. I remember myself when I was 19. I had a lot of enthusiasm. And, you know, the world was my oyster. And I think that's how he felt. And he didn't have patience for necessarily planning out careful strategies and waiting and so forth. But he learned. And I think that people like Washington and D'Estaing, the French admiral, although, you know, they initially were maybe a bit annoyed that he was issuing orders, they really understood that it was coming from a good place, I think. They understood that he was someone who had only the best of intentions, and they counseled him, and he learned, which is more than many people can say. You know, I think he really listened to the very wise counsel he was getting from senior officers. And he adapted his behavior accordingly and really became quite an excellent military leader.
He was well known at the end of the Revolution and sort of beloved in the hearts of Americans. He returns to France. He's living life in France. His home's becoming a salon for the Americans that are coming to Paris after the war and, you know, setting about creating a new country. But then here comes the Revolution in France. And then, as we talked about earlier, he tries to chart a middle course. I think his ideal for France was a constitutional monarchy, where you really had a parliament that functioned, and the king was more of an advisor than an autocrat.
Yep.
And Lilly was just unable to negotiate the two forces between him, and was reviled by both. And in fact, at some point during the Reign of Terror, they were after him.
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. If he had not fled the country in 1792, he would almost certainly have been executed. He left France on the same day that the Jacobin-led National Assembly issued an official order for his arrest. He had at that point alienated both the Royalists and the Republicans, and he was very much persona non grata. He ended up fleeing to the Austrian Netherlands. And, you know, it's another one of these moments, though. He truly was earnest, and he was truly idealistic. And apparently when he left France, he believed that he was just going to pass through Austrian territory and come to the United States.
And, of course, the Austrian Netherlands, which is Belgium, also ruled by a royal family, said, let's see, you start a revolution in France, you're in a part of a revolution in France, you were part of American Revolution. I think we have a good place for you, and that was prison.
Exactly. And, you know, Austria wasn't simply, it wasn't just any monarchy, but Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France.
Right, she's from Austria. Yeah, she's Austrian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, in fact, it was personal for them. And so he spent the next 7 years in prison and exile, and he was shuttled from prison to prison. Eventually, his wife, Adrienne, actually, I think, became extremely influential in getting him out of prison because she decided to lock herself up with him as well as her daughters. She essentially showed up at the Austrian prison with her two daughters and said, if you're going to keep my husband, you're going to keep us too. And this was something that really broke hearts around the world, the selfless actions of this woman who would sacrifice her own liberty and that of her children to be with her husband, created a great outpouring of affection for that whole family and really went a long way towards inspiring Austria to finally let him go.
Hmm. Interesting. My guest today is Laura Riccio. The name of her new book is The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. It's published by Knopf. Well, after the French Revolution and after Napoleon took power, he sort of retired in a way, didn't he?
Yeah, you know, in this way, he was a bit like Washington. You know how Washington twice retired, once after when he resigned his military commission, and then again after his presidency, Washington retired to his farm at Mount Vernon, and this was an ideal that Lafayette shared as well. And Lafayette created his own farm at La Grange outside of Paris. And this is where, as you were saying earlier, he imported many American species, American plants. He called it American ground. He welcomed visiting Americans. He collected American memorabilia. He had what he called an American museum. He did enter back into politics a bit, but for the most part, his final years were really spent basking in his family, in his reputation, and in the company of visiting Americans.
He's so American.
Yeah.
You know, his mannerisms were far more American than French for the time.
Absolutely.
He had fame in America. He never immigrated and just became an American. He sort of was truly a Frenchman who had this dual love.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You know, I think it was John Adams, actually, who, as we said earlier, John Adams and he did not always get along. And John Adams was actually somewhat suspicious of what he saw as Lafayette's dual character. And he thought that this sort of duality could not last long. But it actually did. I think at his very heart, I think that Lafayette was really equally French and American. He was very proud of his own country and his own nation. And in fact, he at one point when he was young again, there was a time in his life when he was quite young and he was always ready to challenge somebody to a duel. And at one point, he was ready to challenge someone to a duel because they had insulted France's honor. So American though he was also every ounce a Frenchman. And I think that maybe is part of the reason why he's maybe less appreciated in France. And in America, we know him, we know his name, we love him, but we don't necessarily know a whole lot about what he did in France because it's sort of a whole other half of his life.
Yeah, and he was sort of a fish out of water.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. And, you know, when he was in America, he was a Frenchman in America, and when he was in France, he was an American in Paris.
Interesting. at the very beginning of the book, you take us into, I think it's in Versailles.
Yes.
Back in a dusty part of the building, there's this bust of Lafayette. And the curator says, why do you suppose this is here?
Exactly.
So can you give us an answer? Why do you suppose that was here? Because he was not a courtier of any consequence. He was, you know, far better known in America than in France, and certainly more beloved than in France. So why is that bust
so
there?
The bust that's in the bust that's at Versailles of Lafayette, it's a beautiful marble bust, which is, as you say, and as I describe in the book, is kept in this sort of outbuilding, this dusty area that, you know, nobody would ever go to. But the reason it's there is because there was a brief period of time at the start of the French Revolution, 1789, 1790, when Lafayette was seen as the French George Washington, and people believed that he might, like Washington, be able to lead his nation to a new era of liberty and freedom. And that bust was commissioned at that point by the National Guard of Paris. The National Guard, he was the commander of the National Guard. Mm-hmm. And the National Guard of Paris commissioned that bust in his honor. And the fact that it was not destroyed during the revolution is surprising. Another bust that they had of him was destroyed during the French Revolution in a public act after his reputation fell. It was destroyed on the streets of Paris, smashed. But this one had been given to the town of Orléans in France and somehow managed to survive, maybe because it was out of the Parisian spotlight, and it made its way to Versailles. Didn't make its way on view, but... but it's there, and it's a remnant of that brief moment when Lafayette seemed as though he could become the French George Washington.
Well, Lafayette still is remembered, his name on everything from universities to the square across the street from the White House.
Absolutely.
To countless schools. Your book title says Lafayette Reconsidered. How should we reconsider Lafayette?
Well, you know, part of my hope, honestly, was to turn him into a human being. Not a statue, not a bust, not the name of a street or a school or a town, but a human being. And part of my goal was really to try to recreate what it might have been like to be 19 years old, to feel a compulsion to travel across the ocean, which in those days was no easy feat, to live in a country and fight a war that was really none of your immediate concern. You know, what was it that compelled this man to do this, and what was it like coming of age in the international spotlight? And then what happened when, as he aged and as he clung to principles of truth and liberty, ideals he really believed in, and then saw them crumble around him, what must that have been like? And so I guess that what I try to do is, I guess I believe that Lafayette deserves a bust. He deserves to be remembered in marble, but I also think that he deserves to be understood as a human being of flesh and blood, and that's really what I was trying to do.
All right. Laura Riccio, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Laura Riccio is the Dean of the School of Undergraduate Studies at the New School in New York City and the author of The Marquis, Lafayette Reconsidered. It's published by Alfred Knopf. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.